This is Fresh Air. In a perfect world, childhood is a time to explore and experience life free from anxieties about danger and violence. But for many children, from Somalia and Bosnia to American inner cities, violence is a daily occurrence. More and more, young people in cities like Chicago, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles witness violent acts, beatings, stabbings, and murders in their own homes and neighborhoods. They're acquainted with the victim. They know the perpetrator. Many have been victims themselves. Child psychologist James Garbarino has been talking with children in war zones around the world to find out the psychological toll that chronic violence has on their development. He's the director of the Erickson Institute, a research and education center in Chicago. Garbarino is a leading authority on how children cope with war and violence. He's co-authored several books on the subject, including No Place to Be a Child and Children in Danger. He's talked with children in Iraq and Kuwait after the war in the Persian Gulf, in the West Bank and Gaza, in Mozambique, Cambodia, Nicaragua, and in America's inner cities. I asked him what children in all these war zones have in common.
In some inner city neighborhoods, by the time kids are 15, more than 30% will have witnessed a homicide. More than 70% will have witnessed a life-threatening assault. That's not fundamentally different from what people have found in war zones around the world. What is very different is that typically in a war zone abroad, the community and the family is likely to be intact and functioning. There's likely to be a collective sense of identity and some group purpose, that the war is to serve some purpose, even if it's one you don't agree with. And finally, that there is the prospect of a way to end it, that there is a possibility of a political settlement that will produce an end to the hostilities. When that hope disappears in war zones abroad, you get the kind of demoralization and depression and violence within the group that I think you find in American inner city neighborhoods.
In talking to children that grow up and live in war zones, do they want to talk to you about the violence that they have to survive?
Well, I'd say it depends. A lot of kids are quite willing to talk if they get the message that you really want to hear about it. Some kids kind of test adults to see if they're really ready to hear, if they're willing to hear. It's very threatening for adults to hear these messages. Most adults find it very disturbing to think that children are being traumatized, that children are having these experiences. Parents particularly are often overwhelmed with guilt and anxiety to think that their children are having it so bad. Most of the children realize how upsetting it is to tell their parents that things are bad, and so they try to protect them from that, they keep them from that. It's also humiliating often for the child to admit that they feel so afraid. So they may be keeping it back, and the parents also may not be asking, in part because they don't know what to do if they hear the answer. Often professionals don't ask because they don't know what to do when they hear the answer. We've spoken with teachers in public schools in Chicago who said that they had discontinued having show and tell, you know, the traditional show and tell where you open up the floor to the kids in kindergarten and first grade and, you know, tell what you want to tell about, share your experience. Significant number of teachers discontinue that because they don't know what to do, or they can't deal with their own feelings when the kid says, well, I want to talk about the body that was found outside our building over the weekend.
So you're really saying that more and more children are having less and less of an outlet to talk about the violence in their lives because the parents or the adults can't listen.
I think that's often the case, yes.
For children that have witnessed a murder, what do they tell you? What are some of the stories that they've told you, and how do they express what it is that they've seen?
Well, in the immediate aftermath, often they're really highly aroused, and that's part of what trauma is. It's this overwhelming arousal. It's kind of having your circuits blown by something that is just too much. In the first minutes and hours and days, sometimes they're really shocked, as you might expect. They may be very, very quiet, or they may simply be unable to stop talking about it, wanting to rehearse and report the event over and over again. After that initial period, children generally kind of develop a more deliberate account, a deliberate story of what they've seen, and they may want to kind of get beyond it and may even be reluctant to talk about it because, in part because they see how adults respond. Adults, the most common reaction of adults is after a relatively short period to try to give children the message, well, forget about it, it's over, put it behind you. And children receive that message and then often stop publicly talking about it. But in fact, they really need the opportunity to come back and to recover that ground a number of times. And so they may want to draw it out and tell you a story about the drawing. They may want to hear your interpretation of what they've told you and then revisit it again next week or next month.
James Garbarino is my guest today, and he's the president of the Erickson Institute, which is located in Chicago. He's an authority on the effect of violence, community violence on children, the author or co-author of several books, including No Place to Be a Child, Growing Up in a War Zone, and his latest called Children in Danger, Coping with the Consequences of Community Violence. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with James Garbarino, and he's an authority on the effect of violence and community violence on children. What do you see as the difference between TV violence and flesh and blood violence? If a child witnesses a television program and they see someone gunned down on the tube, and they look out their apartment window and they see someone gunned down on the street, how do they process that?
Well, you know, the answer I would have given a few years ago was pretty straightforward, that the research on the impact of television violence has told us now, accumulating over 30 years, that most of the effect of watching television violence occurs among children who've had real-life experiences with violence, that there's a kind of interaction between having had violent experience in your real life and seeing it on television that amplifies the effects and leads to more aggression on your part. And I think that's pretty well established. Now, just taking it that far, that means that as more and more kids have real-life experiences with violence, they become more and more vulnerable to violence on television. And that would be kind of one answer. But in recent years, I think we're seeing children exposed to a type of television violence which is really different, qualitatively different from what went before.
How so?
Well, I think that the exposure of children to, but through cable television particularly, through the access to VCR, which brings into homes movies that, you know, might never be shown on television, and the increasing tolerance of television, both cable and broadcast, for really pornographic violence, means that more and more children are being exposed to violent images which are so powerful that they can be traumatic in their own right.
I don't want to get off on a tangent here, but I want to ask you, just in this vein, comparing the kind of trauma of the Freddy Krueger movies and children observing that, and the kind of trauma that you see in fairy tales, where oftentimes children are abandoned by their parents and raised by wicked and ugly stepmothers. Would you say that's also a trauma for children? I know many people that were traumatized by many of the Disney movies, of course, the Dumbos and the Bambis.
Mm-hmm. I think that the traditional fairy tales, some of them have certainly these very powerful and potentially traumatic themes to them. The saving grace there is often that they are verbally produced, or verbally communicated, which protects the child in some ways from some of the images. It's still true that those stories can have this upsetting and even traumatic effect on children if they're coupled with real-life experiences that the child has. But there is this kind of mediation of the message through the words. My real concern is that the modern televised violence, the Freddy Krueger violence, doesn't have this mediation. It is direct assault on the child. I would say it's like, you know, teaching children about violence with Freddy Krueger is like teaching them about sex through showing them hardcore pornography. Mm. The imagery is just too much for the child to deal with, given what they know, given their intellectual abilities, given their cognitive abilities. It's just too much for the child. And when you figure that a couple of people have, when they've done little surveys, have reported that something like 15% of the first graders that have been asked say they have seen the Nightmare on Elm Street movies or the Halloween movies. And you add to that that, I know when I go around the country and talk with professional groups, if you ask people who work as child therapists about these movies, over and over again they will talk about how these movies, the Freddy Kruegers and so on, are caught up with or implicated in the problems that they're seeing with young children, children who are emotionally disturbed. I think it's a kind of wild card that's been thrown out into the culture, and it would be bad enough if there was nothing in real life to echo those films or to resonate with them. But if a growing number of kids have real life experiences which are threatening, and then they are exposed to these kind of vicious media images, I think there's a real potential for harm.
I'm speaking with James Garbarino about the effect of community violence on children. Do you see that inner city schools should move more into the social services realm, move beyond the three R's?
Well, you know, the reason I got involved in child development initially was that I was a classroom teacher, actually in a junior high school. And when the 10th kid came in, you know, drunk or had been arrested by the police, I decided that my ability to do the job in the classroom was being undermined by what was going on outside. And I think that's an important recognition that all schools have, that your ability to function in the school depends a lot on the quality of life outside the school. And so it's incumbent on schools to take a leadership role in looking at the quality and the texture of children's lives the other hours of the day so they can do their job better.
Well, what do you think about bringing in peacekeeping forces the way we've done in Somalia to bring some kind of order to the chaos of the inner cities?
Well, I think the UN concept of peacekeeping is probably an important idea for some inner city neighborhoods, because you have a kind of catch-22 going on where the police force cannot do the job because of the overwhelming social problems, and the social services cannot do the job because they're not physically safe. So what you need is, I think you need a strong emphasis on community policing, which might be the kind of domestic equivalent to the UN peacekeeping force, where the police are taken out of the cars, put on the streets, a lot of storefront kind of substations for the police, a lot of meetings between the police and local community leaders, where citizens have a sense that they and the police are allies in trying to take back control of the streets. And then you add into that this human services, social services mixture, and then you have something which has a chance of making a difference. Somalia is a good example because it's very clear from the news reports that just sending in the Marines in a military way only provides a very temporary solution and is not going to produce long-term security. However, when the Marines move into this larger role of building up local resources, of training local security forces to maintain control, of allowing enough safety in which a political process can take place, then you can get real peacekeeping.
In a minute, we'll continue our discussion with James Garbarino about children and violence. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with child psychologist James Garbarino, co-author of the new book, Children in Danger. We've spent this time really talking about the violence on the streets, but I wonder, looking at the violence that often happens inside of homes, the kind of domestic violence that children have to cope with, is that a more dangerous violence psychologically when it's happening inside the home?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because I think will be growing evidence, and there's already some, that just as The kids who are most vulnerable to TV violence are the kids who have real-life violence. The kids who are most vulnerable to the violence in the community are the kids who have violence at home. That rather than immunizing you against further violence, it heightens your vulnerability. So the kids we're most concerned about are kids who are abused and neglected at home, who then go out to face a violent community. They're the ones most likely to be infected by that violence. They're the ones most likely to be drawn to it. And in fact, if you drew a map of most cities like Chicago and put pins on the map for all of the domestic violence cases, the child abuse cases, the children who are killed by parents, and then put pins on the map for all the community violence cases, you would find very similar patterns, that there's a tremendous overlap. It's the catch-22 of American life, that those who are at risk the most in one way typically are at risk the most in another way. And of course, the other thing is that what is community violence from one perspective may be domestic violence from another. If a kid is beaten or a wife is beaten inside an apartment or on a porch of a house, that's domestic violence for them, but it's community violence for everybody else.
You've really described a very dark and depressing issue, this whole issue of urban violence. You also said you never want to give up on a particular child, but do you feel that there is a generation of young people now getting into adulthood that are just lost? I mean, they have lost their childhood and they're lost as adults.
Well, I think under the current way of dealing with them and thinking about them, they may well be lost in the sense that if we continue to respond with incarceration as a way of dealing with the drug economy, they probably are lost. We have one of the highest incarceration rates around. There are neighborhoods in our cities where, you know, two-thirds of all the young men between 18 and 30 either are in jail, awaiting sentencing, on parole. And every time we send someone to a prison, you know, we're sending out ripples of destruction in that life, in that family, in that community. So I think that has to change. We have to find some other way to deal with those young offenders, or we really will sentence that whole generation to economic and social disaster. No way around it, I think.
You're an authority on this whole issue of violence in children. Has that changed you as a parent?
Well, it certainly has placed a lot of demands on me as a parent. I have two children, and at least a couple of ways. One, I really have to be very careful about screening and monitoring kind of what I talk about at the dinner table. I was in Kuwait at the end of the war. I'll probably be going to Croatia and Bosnia later this month. And bringing home those experiences, which I need to talk about, I need to write about, is something I have to shield my own children from.
Do you have to control the impulse to want to rescue or adopt all these children that you've spent time talking with?
I certainly do. In fact, I've been working on a novel about that has a clinical psychologist who works with children in war, partly as a hobby. And in the novel, the psychologist has adopted a child from every one of the war zones that he's been to. And it was clearly a kind of wish fulfillment in the novel.
So if you can do it in fiction, it helps in real life.
That's right. And that is a very strong impulse that lots of people have to rescue a child. It's understandable. It generally is the least adequate response. As an example, I've been working with the government in Spain, and initially they wanted to bring over thousands of orphans from Bosnia and Croatia to come into Spain and be adopted, and they had 10,000 Spanish families who wanted to adopt these kids. And after talking about it and going over the history of this sort of thing, I think they came to realize that saving individual children like that is a very small part of the solution. And now they've changed the focus of the program. They're bringing mothers and children. They're bringing families, displaced families, to Spain for a period of time to make them safe, to help them rebuild before they go back to their country. So the immediate solution is not always the best one, and rescuing individual children, while emotionally appealing, is not nearly so important as investing in protecting communities and making communities safer. And that's a tough lesson for any culture. I think it's particularly difficult for American culture, which responds so well to the plight of the individual child, often not seeing the context of the family and the community that child is in. And if you rip the child out of that, you may well be doing more harm in the long run than if you find a way to support the child in that community.
James Garbarino, thank you very much for talking about children and the effect of community violence on children. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
James Garbarino. His books include Children in Danger and No Place to Be a Child.